Our leaders and policymakers should read more science fiction. That's the advice of Australia's chief scientist, Alan Finkel. Science fiction is a hub of ideas for future technology, and it workshops how our society may change, for better or worse, depending on the choices we make about the use of that technology. This lecture was first broadcast in 2017 as part of the Cranlana program.
In the year that I graduated from high school, which was 1970, a man named Alvin Toffler took the world by storm with a best-selling book. And these days, it's barely remembered. But back then, it was big. The cover was purple, space-age purple. And the title was Future Shock. All around him, Toffler saw them suffering, people for whom change was too fast and adaptation too slow. They were stuck behind their times, strangers, lost in the present, frightened, adrift, confused. All they knew was that they could never go home. Home was in the past, and the past was dead. It was gone. Future shock, the shell shock of time. The image that springs to mind for me when I think of those future-shocked people is the Mars One project. You may have seen it in the media. And when it was first announced, way back in 2012, I was personally very excited. I'm not so excited now, and you'll see why. The idea is to establish a permanent human colony on Mars by 2035. Here's the deal. You sign up to be a colonist. You pay your application fee, which gets you into the queue. If you're lucky, your application letter might get read. And if you're extra, extra lucky, you might get an interview, pass the medical clearance, sail through the Mars settler suitability interview, and be named in the final four. You're strapped into a space capsule and taken on a 7-month voyage to Mars. When you land, if you haven't suffered permanent damage from cosmic radiation on the voyage or gone mad from claustrophobia, you take up residence in a life pod, 10 metres by 50 metres. And then you stay there for the rest of your natural life. Yes, until you die. The technology doesn't exist to bring you home. You're trapped on an alien planet for life. Now, that sounds bad, but according to Alvin Toffler, future shock might actually be worse. At least when you sign up for the one-way ticket to Mars, you're travelling as a volunteer. But the future, it never asks if you want to come along. The future doesn't test if you're ready and resilient. The future doesn't train you. It doesn't prepare you, equip you. No, it just blows up your home planet, hurls you into space. On and on, faster and faster, a stomach-churning and heart-sinking and gut-wrenching ride for the rest of your life. For just 5 seconds, hold that image in your mind. That's future shock. And Alvin Toffler, he wasn't kidding when he called it a disease. He meant it literally. Something you could experience as a physical and psychological condition. Or, as he put it, the shattering stress and disorientation that we induce in individuals by subjecting them to too much change in too short a time. And this was something that he detected in 1970. 1970, years before personal computers, the internet, the smartphone. It's the age of Twiggy and the Beatles, when words like cloning still appear in Toffler's book in inverted commas. And the author has to apologise for the outlandish idea that maybe, just maybe, you could take a frozen embryo and choose a human surrogate and grow a human baby. Toffler expressed it like this, and I've updated the numbers for our time. Take the last 50,000 years of human existence, divided into approximately 800 lifetimes of 60 years, which is somewhere between the lifespan of an ancient and modern human. Of these 800 lifetimes, 650 were spent in caves. Only in the last 70 lifetimes have we known any form of writing. Only in the last 6 lifetimes have we had the printing press. Only during the last 3 lifetimes has anyone, anywhere, ever used an electric motor. And almost everything material in your world today, every object, every technology, every building, was developed in the last lifetime. The 800th lifetime, your lifetime. It's no wonder that Alvin Toffler detected the symptoms of mass confusion and sheer exhaustion in the people around him. And he would undoubtedly concur with Jack Welch, the legendary leader of the corporate giant GE, and the author of the immortal line that now has the status of a law. If the rate of change on the outside exceeds the rate of change on the inside, the end is near. But Toffler detected something other than future shock in pockets of the population. A handful of men and women, not many, but a few, were racing to the future, not as hostages, but as pilots and willing passengers. Some of them were actually signing up to build the rocket. And in their mind was a vision of the future as a better place that might be different and strange, but joyous at the same time. Something that would be, for all humanity, a new home. They travelled with wonder, with hope and conviction. They were proud to be human and free. And Toffler asked himself what it would take to make the journey to the future a voyage like that, not just for the few, but for the many. Now, I repeat, this was 1970. So Toffler had some unconventional ideas on how we might go about solving this conundrum. He was right when he predicted the gig economy, Instagram celebrities, and a more embracing definition of marriage. He was wrong on colonising the oceans, human cloning, and controlling the weather. But buried in Toffler's book is a kernel that I take very seriously, not just as Australia's 8th chief scientist, but as a lifelong optimist. An optimist with, yes, a genuine bona fide ticket to space. I bought it from Richard Branson's space tourism venture, Virgin Galactic, and someday I hope to use it. But back to Toffler and the big idea. Here he is pondering on an incredibly powerful technology that he believes could ultimately save mankind from riots, chaos, war, and civilizational collapse. And I'll quote a few sentences. If the contemporary individual is going to have to cope with the equivalent of millennia of change within the compressed span of a single lifetime, he must carry within his skull images of the future. We must begin by making speculation about the future respectable. Our children should be studying Arthur C. Clarke, William Tenn, Robert Heinlein, Ray Bradbury, and Robert Sheckley. Not because these writers can tell them about rocket ships and time machines, but more importantly, because they can lead young minds through an imaginative exploration of the jungle of political, social, psychological, and ethical issues that will confront these children as adults. Science fiction should be required reading in the compulsory unit Future 101. End of quote. That's Toffler's ultimate technology. The story. Imagination. Science fiction. No, it's not what you expected to hear when you passed into the rarefied halls of the Cranlana Institute tonight. But I hope to persuade you that science fiction is a respectable pursuit for leaders such as yourselves. And it's more than respectable. Leaders, future leaders, friends of future leaders, for you, science fiction is required. First, to help you understand the past. Second, to help you grasp the future. And third, to help you act in the here and now. But first, there's a qualifier and a caveat. The qualifier is that the science fiction in question has to be good. And by good, I mean my definition of good, which means that it has to pass two tests. First, it has to have scientific plausibility, in the sense that it builds on our existing technologies or is at least broadly consistent with our best understanding of the laws of physics. And I call this the no magic rule. And second, it has to have narrative plausibility, in the sense that it strikes us as a fair representation of how human beings might actually behave. And I call this the human factor. No to magic, yes to human. I impose these tests not for reasons of snobbery or to suggest that you can't learn anything from books or films that don't meet the rules. Of course you can. But you're not engaged in what Toffler called social futurism, and we might call future thinking. When writers or directors pass my tests, no to magic, yes to human, it confirms that they have actually sat down, taken their concepts and turned them over and over in their heads. They can tell you what their worlds would look like, taste like, smell like, feel like. And so they are forcing you to experience a possible way of being human. So that's the qualifier. Now for the caveat. Science fiction is not an alternative to learning science. I don't think you can toss away the textbook and screen The Terminator to your class. You might use The Terminator to catch a student's attention and overcome the ridiculous divide in our minds between maths and English, between science and arts. Let the kids who love English discover science in a film or a book. Let the kids who love science start thinking about society and culture through a story. Let them think and dream together. And let's make them all read piles of books. It's just a thought. But of course, for any subject, it's not enough to simply catch the eye. The secret is to capture the heart. You need to have the passion to push through the drills and the tests and keep going. That's the difference between entertainment and education. It's important, so let's respect it. Now, let's begin. Textbooks open. Welcome to Future 101. The first reason you need science fiction is to understand the journey from the past to the way you live today. You might not know it, but you live in a world imagined for you and scripted for you in science fiction. For some of us, this is literally true. We call it Pokemon Go. But we could also point to the inhabitants of Second Life, a 3D virtual world where people meet, shop, and trade by their avatars. You can trade Second Life money for real money. And you can study in Second Life towards a real degree. Universities have adopted the platform so that students on opposite sides of the world can work together in real-world problem scenarios. The creator of Second Life was directly inspired by fiction, the metaverse, depicted in Neal Stephenson's 1992 novel, Snow Crash. And of course, Second Life has gone on to inspire later works of fiction. One of the joys of reading the great novels of the past is to follow the weaving pattern of ideas like this, from fiction into fact and back into fiction, like two opposing mirrors, endlessly bouncing rays of light. Perhaps some of the greatest examples of science fiction's impact on society are the ones that we now consider boringly normal. The ubiquitous office scanner and the photocopier were carefully described by Isaac Asimov in his Space Ranger book published in 1952, 5 years before the very first image scanner was invented. An electronic fingerprint scanner, like the one I used to unlock my iPhone, was used in the exact same book. Asimov also envisaged the use of a personal portable computer in 1954, more than 20 years before the first clunky laptops hit the shelves in 1975. Or take Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game, published in 1985. He envisaged a world where students use flat touchscreen computers in class, where citizens could access the nets for worldwide digital communication, and where anyone could comment on politics while hidden behind a digital identity. And today we call these tablets, the internet, and social media. It's a reminder that every great human advance is preceded by a leap in imagination. And if we learn nothing else from science fiction, that alone would make the effort worthwhile. So, science fiction is essential to you as a student of history, looking to learn from the past. The second reason you need to pay attention to science fiction is as a student of the future, looking to grasp the world ahead. Now, I sense your anxiety, and I understand. We associate speculating about the future with prophecy, with voodoo and astrology and economics. Did I say that? My apologies. Voodoo, astrology and magic. As a leader, I agree that scepticism has merit. But like all things, in moderation. Too much scepticism simply blinds you to opportunity. The horse is here to stay, but the automobile is only a novelty, a fad. That was the president of the Michigan Savings Bank advising Henry Ford's lawyer not to invest in the Ford Motor Company back in 1903. Heavier-than-air flying machines are impossible. That was Lord Kelvin, the president of the Royal Society of England, 1895. The Wright brothers proved him wrong just 8 years later. There is no chance that the iPhone is going to get any significant market share. No chance. That was Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft, in 2007. Yes, looking ahead, imagining change, it does carry some risk. But it's important. And any leader who ignores it is unworthy of the position.
Alan Finkel, Australia's chief scientist. You can hear the full lecture broadcast on Big Ideas in 2017 by following the hot link on the Big Ideas homepage. This is Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.